This is White Sox Weekly, your all-access pass to everything White Sox.
Swing and a drive! Deep to left! Gone!
That was as hard as a baseball can be hit by anybody.
White Sox Weekly on the home of the White Sox, ESPN Chicago.
Now, here's your host, Jeff Mellor.
Good afternoon. Happy Saturday to you. Hope you're enjoying your weekend. Welcome on into White Sox Weekly. Getting set for game number 2 of 3 between the White Sox and Royals tonight at Kauffman Stadium in KC, in which the White Sox have lost 12 games in a row. That is right. It has been a house of horrors for the White Sox in Kansas City over the last 2 seasons, and they will try and get right tonight after a loss yesterday in which they fell 3-1 and the offense was sputtering a bit. Now, the home run ball is something that has not evaded the White Sox since the start of the second half of the season. And last night was no exception.
The pitch, a swing and a line drive caught by Witt, double play. Montgomery got caught off the bag at second.
That is something that will drive the skipper, Will Venable, very insane.
So that actually was the key moment in last night's ball game. We jumped the gun a bit there. That was Lenin Sosa coming to the plate.
It is. Swinging a fly.
That was Lenin Sosa coming to the plate in the bottom of the sixth inning. I'm sorry, the top of the sixth inning with the bases loaded. But let's rewind just a bit here. So last night, Lenin Sosa did come to the dish, and he had an opportunity to pull the White Sox back within one, and he did that. And every time, by the way, that Lenin Sosa hits a home run, he is setting a career high because he's already set a career high. So he went to the plate and, again, set a new career high.
It is. Swinging a fly ball, well hit to left. Way back there and gone, and we're tied. Lenin Sosa.
He got it right. He looked to that inside corner and committed to a fastball and getting the barrel out there.
So there we go. Lenin Sosa's 15th home run of the season. Yet again, a new career high. It does make you wonder what exactly the future holds for Lenin Sosa. He has continued to get better at the dish all season long. I do think defensively he is a liability at times. So that's something that he's going to need to work on if he is going to be a mainstay, somebody you can count on as a regular. But last night he was DHing, and he did exactly what you would hope a designated hitter would do, and that's hit a home run. Again, his 15th of the year, a career high. And now we move forward to the top of the sixth. Lenin Sosa did hit the ball hard, unfortunately, with the bases loaded and an opportunity for the White Sox to try and take the lead against the Royals, trailing 2-1. Unfortunately, it was right at someone, and Colson Montgomery wandered a bit too far off of the bag.
The pitch, a swing and a line drive caught by Witt, double play. Montgomery got caught off the bag at second.
That is something that will drive the skipper, Will Venable, very insane.
No doubt about it. Montgomery's first move on a sharply hit ball like that needs to be back to the base, because certainly, you need to be aware not to be doubled up in that situation. And young rookie player Colson Montgomery, who's obviously done a lot right so far this year, but the fundamentals, they can cost you at times. And in that moment, if you look back now, it was certainly a key moment because the White Sox end up losing that 3-1. That ends the threat. If he gets back and it's only a line out, certainly the White Sox will have an opportunity to try and do some more damage with the bases still loaded. But of course, that ends the inning. And after that, the White Sox go on and fail to score any more runs in the ballgame. And that is how the game ended. And part of the reason why the White Sox continue to struggle in KC, because they miss their opportunities and moments in situations like that. White Sox manager Will Venable talked about the loss last night after the game.
Well, it was great tonight. Quality start there. Cover 6 innings, only 3 runs. I don't think he really got in a ton of trouble. Any trouble he did get into, he did a good job working around, so outstanding outing from there.
You guys were able to get some guys on, but just weren't able to get them in. Just What did you see from the offensive standpoint tonight?
Yeah, just couldn't string anything together. You know, had the bases loaded there. Colson getting doubled off. You know, got to be better there. That can't happen. Yeah, just couldn't really get anything going. You know, just thought we got beat in the zone a lot, which we've seen a little bit here recently after doing a nice job on the fastball. So, yeah, just got to keep going.
Another big hit for Lanin. What is he continuing to keep on doing at the plate here?
Just good swings on good pitches, making quality decisions, seeing the chase rate go down. He just keeps putting himself in a good spot. And, you know, his bat is dangerous on good pitches, and he's done a really nice job.
You know, we talked about it pregame. That was the first time we've seen the infield together with me, Borges, Colson. Just how nice was it? And to see those young guys out there.
Yeah, it was great. They did a great job. Some nice plays all the way around there in the infield. Nice to see the double play combo with Chase and Colson there. So, you know, really nice to see those guys out there playing good defense.
You mentioned the double play there. Yeah, just what did you see in that sixth inning double play that with the bases loaded?
Yeah, just got to go back on line drive, head high line drive. Not really anywhere to go. Just got to work back to the base. You know, something that we drill and we talk about. And, you know, when you're out there, sometimes just speeds up on you. And just, you know, one of those, he's got to get back to second base.
It's kind of a quiet couple games for the offense this week. How do you sort of get the guys back in the swing of things?
Yeah, we just got to keep at it. And, you know, we talked about coming out of the break, fastball performance, and committing to the changes that we need to make to make sure that we perform against the fastball. You know, for whatever reason, whether it's us or the pitching that we face, that we've gotten away from a little bit and gotten beaten in the zone. So we just got to get back to the basics, get ready to hit, and put some good swings on some good pitches.
So there you go. Will Venable last night talking about the White Sox loss and failure to do anything more than Lenin Sosa's home run last night. Do have today's lineup for you. Again, first pitch coming your way at 6:10. Mike Tauchman will lead off. He's DHing today. Brings a .274 batting average, 8 homers, 31 ribbies. Lenin Sosa hitting second. He's playing first base today. .273 with 15 homers that we talked about, 49 RBIs. Colson Montgomery playing shortstop today. The lefty bats third. He, of course, is on that prodigious home run pace right now. He's got 10 on the season, 10 homers, 28 RBIs, and he's only hitting .233, though. Luis Robert Jr. in center field cleaning up, hitting .218 with 12 homers, 47 ribbies. He also has 31 bags. Andrew Benintendi hits fifth today. He'll be in left field. The lefty is a .225 hitter on the season, 14 homers, 45 RBIs. Miguel Vargas, who returned from the injured list earlier this week from that oblique injury that he was dealing with, he's going to play third base today, something that Curtis Mead has been doing with frequency. But Mead gets the day off today. Vargas back at third base. He's hitting .228 with a 13 homers and 44 RBIs. Kyle Teal behind the plate, the lefty catcher, is hitting .260 with a couple of homers and 13 RBIs. Chase Mydroth also has returned from the injured list. He had been dealing with that thumb injury after being hit on the thumb wrist area against the Phillies in that last game of their previous homestand. Of course, the White Sox were trying to see if he might be able to avoid an IL stint, but ultimately, after waiting it out for about 3 or 4 days, trying to see if he might be able to grip it, they decided that it just wasn't coming along quickly enough. So they placed him on the injured list. He returned last night to the lineup. And as you heard Will Venable talk about, nice to see the middle infield combination last night playing together, and something I think we can certainly envision for years to come for White Sox fans in the future here. And then finally, rounding out the lineup, it will be Brooks Baldwin in right field, hitting .222 with 7 homers and 26 RBIs. So that's your starting lineup for tonight's game, game number 2 of 3. Sean Burke will be on the mound for the White Sox. He's 4-9 with a 4.26 ERA. He's got a career-high 114 innings so far this year. And so through 122 games, obviously, he will get to the point where, I'm sorry, 112 games. But he'll get to the point where you have to wonder if they will allow him to continue to, you know, how much he will be able to give the White Sox. Will they start to manage his inning workload ever so slightly down the stretch here? I think that's certainly within play, especially with somebody who we're expecting to talk to later in the show, Martin Perez. He returned from the 60-day injured list earlier this week, something that I'm going to talk about here coming up next. But Martin Perez, he certainly could be in the mix to work in a piggyback role We saw that as he returned, and he took the ball from Shane Smith the other day in his return. And so I do wonder if Sean Burke, who's on the mound tonight, again, a career-high 114 innings, if the White Sox will manage his innings down the stretch. I think that's certainly in play, and with someone like Martin Perez in the mix now. Without a rotation spot for Perez, I think that's something that is certainly on the table for Burke. And, oh, by the way, don't forget Jonathan Cannon is pitching in Charlotte. Assuming he gets things right and he makes a return at some point in late August or early September, it'll be easy to manage innings. And I think that's certainly the way the White Sox are going to continue to approach this down the stretch here, with not just Sean Burke, but Shane Smith, of course, is somebody who has never seen this type of workload in his career as a pitcher. So he's going to have to be managed down the stretch. And he had a nice start the last time out as well, even though it didn't result in a victory. So lots of things that Chris Getz and the White Sox organization, working along with Brian Bannister, that the White Sox are going to have to look at here down the stretch as the season. It's going to be about not just trying to win ball games, but also managing the workload of your pitchers and making sure that they're set next season when you return, because 34 games under, you definitely have to take a little bit of a different approach here with your pitching staff. And that's actually something I asked Will Venable about specifically the other day during pregame. I asked him, is dealing with a pitching staff in 2025, now that you've had, again, 112 some odd games here to manage, I said, is it more challenging than you anticipated it being? And he said, listen, no, not really, because that was one of the key points during the interview process. He said, as a managerial candidate, you have to know going into that interview that that is one of your biggest jobs. You have to understand that you're going to have to manage innings. You know, you're going to have to call upon guys in 2025. You don't see pitchers going deep into games like you used to. You don't just have a 4 or 5 man rotation, set it and forget it and don't worry about it. And maybe if your fifth starter isn't performing, you can get creative and turn to someone in the minor leagues. That's not how things operate in 2025. In 2025, you're going to be asking lots and lots of different pitchers throughout your organization to make spot starts, to come up and, you know, grab the ball, be the opener for a day, or occasionally, hey, you know what, we're going to call you up and we're going to see what you got. And as long as you're pitching well, we're going to let you go out there and maybe give us 80, 85 pitches. And that's actually something that happened for the White Sox earlier this week, which was encouraging, something I'm going to discuss when we come back. We'll go through the top five things that I saw from the Sox this week when we come back. Hey, Sox fans, head to the ballpark next Friday, August 22nd, for Elvis Night, presented by Beggar's Pizza, as the White Sox take on the Minnesota Twins at 6:40. Be sure to stay after the game for a post-game fireworks show presented by Beggar's Pizza. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/promos. That's right, Elvis Night next August 22nd. When we come back, we'll run through the top five things for the White Sox this week right here on White Sox Weekly on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. Jeff Meller back on White Sox Weekly. Just so you know the schedule, we are expected to be joined by Martin Perez at some point as he wraps up his work today prior to the White Sox second game in Kansas City. So hoping to have a conversation with Martin Perez. Scott Merkin of MLB.com, who's covered the White Sox for a long time. He actually, I believe, covered the Bananas, Savannah Bananas game last night as well. So we're going to check in with Scott Merkin, talk some Sox with him. I'll let you hear Len Casper's conversation with Waddle and Sylvie. He joins them every Friday. Always fun to listen to Len break down baseball with Waddle and Sylvie here on the flagship station, ESPN 1000. And also going to get you, if you're heading over to Rate Field, or if you're already there and you're getting set to watch the Savannah Bananas, I don't know how familiar you are with some of the rules they have, so we're going to talk about that as well. Executive producer of White Sox Baseball, Brendan Riley, is here with me. We'll chat about what the Savannah Bananas do to make it a fun experience for the fans, and if any of those rules could realistically be adopted in Major League Baseball. But before we do all of that fun stuff, I do want to run through the top five things I saw this past week from the White Sox, and actually Savannah Banana fans and Savannah Banana goers. One of those things occurred last night at Rate Field when you had special celebrity appearances.
And now South Trimble on a couple hops to Ryan Cox, who pulls off the professor. A strike to Bill Leroy over at first. And Mark Burley gets the job done, throwing to A.J. Pierzynski. The crowd goes wild here in right field.
That's right indeed. The special celebrity performers for the Bananas last night, probably to not too many people's surprise who are familiar with how the Bananas do business, but it was A.J. Pierzynski announced early in the game, and then Mark Burley came out of the bullpen to throw to A.J. Pierzynski. So a couple of longtime fan favorites, one of the men who actually has a statue out in right field this year, obviously, that was unveiled. Burley and Pierzynski at the Bananas last night. That was my number five moment of the top five things I saw this past week. How about Yoandres Gomez? And a lot of people probably completely unaware of who Yoandres Gomez is. And he is one of those arms I was talking about in the previous segment. When you look at a baseball team now, it's not just the 25 or 26 man roster nowadays that you worry about, but it's also, hey, what type of arms do we have throughout the organization? And that's why you're constantly seeing waiver claims and additions throughout the season. Yoandres Gomez, boy, he hasn't had an opportunity to start in the big leagues. Well, he finally got a chance, and boy, did he have a great performance earlier this week for the White Sox.
2-2 pitch. Swing and a miss, strike three.
That's a good start.
A stretch in the 1-2. And a swing and a miss, strike three on a cutter. 1-2, swung on and missed, strike three. Swing and a miss, that's strike three. Four strikeouts for Gomez, a 1-2. Swing and a miss, strike three on a curve. That's out number one. A 1-2 pitch, swing and a miss, strike three. New career high in strikeouts for Gomez.
Yes, it was indeed. Seven strikeouts for Gomez in his start for the White Sox the other night against the Detroit Tigers. Gomez actually picks up the win in that one. He goes five innings, 89 pitches, the seven Ks that I mentioned, and also gave up one earned run, one walk, one hit on the day. What was interesting to me was the fact that it looked like he was going to be in line for a tough luck loss after he was down 1-0, and clearly at that point threw five for Gomez, throwing 89 pitches. It certainly seemed like his night was over, so it looked like it was probably going to be a tough spot for him despite a really nice effort. And yet, that's when the White Sox put together six singles against the Tigers in a five-run fifth to secure a win for Yoandres Gomez. And that was nice to see, because with a performance like that, you would have hate to have seen it burned with lack of offense, but the White Sox supported him in the bottom of the fifth with those six singles. And sure enough, Gomez and Will Venable talked about Gomez after that performance, saying, listen, he pitched well enough where he certainly earned another start. So that's going to be the case for Yoandres Gomez, and we'll see what exactly he can provide to the White Sox going forward. These are opportunities, though, on a team that finds themselves where the White Sox are at, 34 games under 500, you're going to have an opportunity to, as a veteran who hasn't really had opportunities in the game, you might be able to make your mark. And it was great to see that from Gomez earlier this week. Another, I think, thing that was great for the White Sox this past week, my third thing of my top five list here, Shane Smith bouncing back to that all-star form.
Swing and a miss on a sinker, strike three. First punch out. Swing and a miss, ball in the dirt. And Carroll will fire to Vargas to complete the out. So back-to-back Ks for Smith. Swing and a miss on a changeup. That's strike three. 1-2 pitch, swing and a miss. Just late and under a good rising fastball from Shane Smith. He has four strikeouts early. Swing and a miss. Strike three.
Five strikeouts and five shutout innings for Shane Smith against the Tigers. Now, the problem was that in this one, the White Sox offense did not back up Shane Smith, as they end up losing that game on Wednesday, the series finale and rubber match to the Tigers, 1-0. But Shane Smith, five shutout innings, five strikeouts after his start against the Mariners, where he went five innings, gave up two earned runs, but also struck out eight. So back-to-back, nice starts from Shane Smith, and he went 92 pitches, which you like to see him get near that mark, because if Shane Smith's going to be an arm the White Sox are going to be able to rely on in their rotation in the future, they're going to need him to consistently be able to go five innings and close to 100 pitches, you know, maybe six, but that's kind of, again, we're in a different era of baseball now, and so really all you're asking for is five from most of your starters, and then after that you will basically assess on a night-by-night basis. So it was good to see Shane Smith put together back-to-back starts, something that has kind of eluded him since the, you know, let's be honest, he made the All-Star team, but his last couple of starts prior to the All-Star break weren't great. So it was nice to see him come out and really pitch well. And same day on Wednesday in that 1-0 loss, how about Martin Perez, who actually suffered the loss in that game? But what I loved to see was just him back on the mound, returning from the 60-day IL after a nearly 4-month absence from the White Sox. The 34-year-old returned after dealing with some forearm tightness. There was some concerns that he might actually have to undergo Tommy John surgery, but after a second opinion with Dr. Keith Meister, Martin Perez was very relieved to learn that he could avoid it and do some rehab work. And now, almost 4 months later, he returns to the mound with a really nice performance, 3 1/3, only gave up one earned run. And so to have that type of, you know, performance in your return after being gone for as long as you did, and after one point initially thinking it was going to be your season, which, again, at 34 years old, you know, if Martin Perez has what would be a second Tommy John surgery, who knows what would remain of a potential career here. So it was really nice to see the vets, who's been a really nice veteran presence in the White Sox clubhouse, return to the mound. And then top thing I saw this weekend happened last Sunday at Wright Field, when Colson Montgomery torpedoed this bomb.
There's a swing and a drive to right, and it's going to go way out of here. That one to the back of the stands. That's out near the new Burley statue. It's 3-0.
Tommy territory, as Connor McKnight called it. 452 feet. What a shot onto the concourse, as Colson Montgomery continues to provide lots of home runs, which we love to see. Hey, Sox fans, save all summer long with our summer savings section. Enjoy $20 weekday and $25 weekend select lower level tickets while supplies last. The summer savings section is presented by Wintrust. Different approach, better results. Includes fees. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/section. Before we take a quick timeout, let's pause 10 seconds for stations to identify themselves. Len Casper, voice of the White Sox, joins Waddle and Sylvie each and every Friday. Always a fun conversation to listen into. So when we come back, if you missed it, we'll eavesdrop and give it a listen again and see what Len had to say about where the White Sox are at and some other interesting topics from around baseball. I'm Jeff Meller. This is White Sox Weekly on the home of the White Sox, the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. Welcome back to White Sox Weekly as we get set for game number two between the two of three between the White Sox and Royals at Kauffman Stadium. Tonight, White Sox need to snap that losing streak in KC. It has been misery in Missouri for the Southsiders. Sox fans, head to the ballpark next Saturday, August 23rd, as the White Sox take on the Twins at 6:10 p.m. First 15,000 fans in attendance will receive a 1980s sweater vest presented by Rates. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/promos. We just discussed Shane Smith's return to form over the last couple of starts. Well, that was the first topic that Waddle and Sylvie addressed with the voice of the White Sox, Len Casper. And they asked him, hey, Len, is Shane Smith back?
Well, his last two have been really good. I just think the eye test would tell you that he looks to be back to being more aggressive, which he was early. I think he looked a little bit tentative right around the All-Star break. DJ had mentioned maybe putting a little pressure on himself to get to the All-Star game, and then once you're named an All-Star, I mean, he's just had a lot going on this year in his rookie season, but his last two have looked exactly like the guy who we saw the first 2 months. So that's been good. And I think the innings situation is under control. We talked, I think, last week about that. Some of the younger pitchers, they've got to make sure that, you know, they don't stretch out their innings too much. But with Martin Perez back now and with Aaron Civale in the rotation, I think the young pitchers should be pretty well protected the rest of the way.
Len, I think there's 41 games left. What's the message to this team right now? What are we trying to accomplish in the final 41 games?
Well, it's funny you asked that, Tom, because we chatted with Will Venable about that very thing before the game tonight. And he said a lot of the stuff they talked about team-wide around the All-Star break, about being ready for the fastball, that is still something that they want to accentuate and pound home. You got to be able to hit velocity in this league at this time. And I also think with Mydroth back tonight, you know, all of the position player prospects that we had heard about getting to the major leagues, they're all here. The next wave, probably starting with Braden Montgomery, that'll be probably in the middle of next year. So I would not expect any more big names to get here before the end of the season. So this group now gets to play together, and I think that they just want to see how it looks, right? And then Chris Getz and his front office can figure out what do we need to acquire via trade or free agency to supplement this group right now. Curtis Meade is getting a pretty long look, had a chance to play a lot of first with Vargas out, and now has moved over to third with Vargas back. So this is an infield that you could see a lot of here down the stretch with Vargas, Mydroth, Montgomery, and Meade. The two catchers, their development. So I think there are some individual things that Will has talked to certain guys about what he would like to see from them. But I think the general, what do you want to see from this team is continuing to gel, cut down on the defensive mistakes, and I think continue to slug, because that's something they didn't do in the first half, and they've been really good at it since the break.
Of the young group right now, of those players that you were just mentioning, and we heard a Carroll highlight, talked about Montgomery right there, Mydroth coming back, Teal, all those guys, who's the guy that's impressed you the most so far, and who do you think is going to be the best player in the big picture?
Yeah, I anticipated the last part of the question first, but I will say Montgomery has been the most impressive because of this great stretch of home runs. I think he's made good adjustments. He's looked way better defensively than I thought he would at shortstop. He's made some really smart defensive plays, and you know, he hasn't been here that long. It's been about a month and a half, but he looks like a major league shortstop. So that's number one. The second part, it's so hard to make predictions, but this is what we do on these shows, right? Mm-hmm. So I will go Kyle Teal. I think Kyle Teal has a chance to be an all-star catcher. I think offensively the bat really plays, and he's got a lot of things he's got to improve behind the plate, but he's a really hard worker. I love the left-hand bat. I'll go Kyle Teal with Montgomery as a 1A.
Do you think that does the power come eventually with Teal, or is he always going to be a lower power guy?
Well, DJ's talked about, you know, he had a lot of movement, and he started to cut down on it, and he's still hitting the ball in the gaps. So I think that that's the last thing that might show up for Kyle, is the ball going over the fence. But the approach is great. He'll take walks. He plays with a ton of energy. I don't expect him to be a 25 to 30 homer guy, but he could probably be a 15 to 20. Yeah.
Len, I mentioned you've got 41 games left, but you've seen the first 121. You've only got one word to describe what you've seen this year in this team. What word would it be?
Oh, man. Encouraging. I don't know if that's too generic, but yeah, I feel like this team has turned the corner, and the hardest work probably starts now. I think anyone here would tell you that. Coming off a 41 win year last year, they're at 44 now. You know, you hope to maybe try to get to 60 if you can by the end of the season. That's still not good enough by any stretch of the imagination, but I don't have to squint too hard to see a position player group that's really impressive and young. And I love how the White Sox develop their pitching, whether they get guys who have had success before or haven't. There's a long list this year, and I think Adrian Hauser, a great example of that. They turned him into a couple of young prospects, a guy who was kind of pitching in no man's land at AAA with Texas. So I think encouraging is the best word I can use. And I did a season ticket holder thing the other day with Chris Getz, and obviously I don't want to say too much about it. It was a private thing, but like people were excited. You know, they really genuinely said this team is fun. So maybe fun would be the other word I would use.
It's perfect. You led me right into where I wanted to go next, because I was going to ask how often you see Chris Getz, and then you just told me that. So he has implemented a lot of new things, including the way they develop players. Mm-hmm. We always hear about Bannister on the pitching side, and you mentioned that. And the Montgomery resurrection has been fantastic, too, on the hitting side. What do you believe Chris Getz wants to add next internally? I'm not talking about personnel-wise, but something this organization can do better.
Well, continuing to do what they've done. They're still not there yet. And when you talk about infrastructure and the data stuff that everybody has, the White Sox have been behind the rest of the industry. You can't just flip on a switch and hire 50 people and go, we're good. You have to hire the right people. You have to have the right systems in place. And they've made a ton of progress over the last couple of years. But I think that will continue, and that will continue to be a huge priority for Chris and his group. And he's admitted the pitching is ahead of the hitting. So I think maybe more of the emphasis will be on the hitting side of it, developing the guys they have, and also maybe using that stuff to go out and figure out a way to acquire players who they believe they can turn into something better than what they've been wherever they are.
Len, we've talked a lot about managers over the last couple of days. I feel like I have a pretty good understanding of what makes a good football coach, but I'm not so sure I do understand exactly what makes a great manager, having been in this game for as long as you have. What is the most important characteristics that a manager has to have, not just to get you to the high heights, but to ride through the low moments that maybe a team like on the north side would find themselves in right now?
I'm really lucky. I mean, I've been around Jack McCann and Tony La Russa and Lou Piniella, Dusty Baker, Joe Maddon, David Ross, Will Venable. Long list and very different personalities. But I think if I had to distill it down to one or two things, guys, I would say being yourself, being genuine. Guys know when you're trying to be something you're not. Big league clubhouse is a little bit like high school. Everybody has an opinion of everybody else, whether you like it or not. And you kind of get exposed for who you are after a while. So I think the managers, let's say they're like Lou Piniella, who loved you one week and hated you the next and then loved you again. He was like that with everybody. And I think it worked. Dusty Baker was really, really protective of his guys, particularly in the big markets. They love that. So while the fans would criticize Dusty, he liked that they weren't criticizing the players, and the players appreciated that. So I think just being genuine. And then the second part to your question, Tom, is knowing what you don't know. I think the best managers and coaches in all sports know how to surround themselves with people who will tell them things that maybe they didn't want to hear, but they need to hear. And just having an open mind about, I don't know everything, so let me be curious about what the next thing is and what maybe I didn't realize or that I can tweak and add it to, my portfolio, so to speak.
Right.
Len, before we let you go, I know you're in Kansas City and you won't be here, but on the South Side this weekend, there's a huge baseball event going on with the Savannah Bananas. I was telling the audience and Waddle that I'm going with the family tomorrow. The kids are really looking forward to it. I'm interested in it because I grew up going to Harlem Globetrotter games. What do you know about the Savannah Bananas, if anything? And how important is something like this for baseball fans, where, it's another way to bring people out to the ballpark and enjoying the game, even if it is way different than MLB?
I think it's awesome. I've seen it on TV. I'm told that it is way, way, way better in person, and that the event is really for the people in the ballpark more than it is for a television audience. I think it's great for the sport. It looks like the players have totally bought in. They're way in on the fan experience. I think if MLB kind of calls anything from the success of the Bananas, it is that fan interaction and just making sure that we don't forget that they're the people who pay everybody's salary. Sylvie, I would say get there early.
Yes.
I'm told it's
yes.
going to be
packed.
A complete madhouse.
Yes.
My sister and her husband are taking my son and his girlfriend tomorrow, so I look for a full report from them. And I have to imagine, I don't know, that there will be some White Sox stars, right? They always find a way to bring out some surprise guests. So I'm really looking forward to see who ends up in uniform, either on the mound or at the plate.
I was going to say that, Len, and I brought that up to Waddle, that like I was watching the Carolina version of it, and Greg Olson played, Luke Kuechly played. Like, I could imagine Jim Thome stepping to the plate. He still lives in town, who is a beloved guy, Hall of Fame player, something like that. Am I onto something?
No, that's a perfect idea. DJ the other night said, because we were talking about this, he said, how about Keith Foulke? And I was like, you do know that he played for the Reds or the played at Fenway for the Bananas like a month ago, right? He had no idea. He just picked a random White Sox pitcher from the past 25 years. Yeah, Keith Foulke actually got in there. So, yeah, I don't know. Maybe Ron Karkovice will show up.
Yeah, that was Len Casper's conversation with Waddle and Sylvie Carco. If you were at the game last night, you were treated to a surprise. We will get into that in just a moment as Mark Burley and A.J. Pierzynski both were playing for the Bananas last night. And obviously, I will be curious to see who makes the special celebrity appearance tonight. I'd anticipate one if you're going to the Bananas game tonight at Rate Field. We're going to roll up our sleeves and talk a little bit about that next segment here on White Sox Weekly. For those who are unfamiliar with it, the Bananas have special banana ball rules, which I'm going to run through with the executive producer of White Sox Baseball, Brendan Riley. We're going to do that next and talk a little bit about some of the possibilities of any of these rules for banana ball being adopted by Major League Baseball. We'll do that in a minute here. White Sox fans, there's still time to win a one-of-a-kind experience this season. Enter the Ultimate Fan Sweepstakes for your chance to win a 2026 suite for a game. The winner will receive a 20-person suite for a mutually agreed-upon game in 2026. Host your friends and family in luxury while cheering on the Sox. To enter, visit whitesox.com/sweepstakes. All right, banana ball. If you're going to the game, if you're already in the parking lot getting ready to attend the festivities, we will tell you about the special banana ball rules when we come back right here on White Sox Weekly on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Now coming to bat, a two-time All-Star and World Series champion with your Chicago White Sox, please welcome A.J. Pierzynski!
Little sampling courtesy of Banana TV. That's right, the Savannah Bananas in town. And they are selling out Rate Field. They did last night. They have done so tonight as they will wrap up their two games at Rate Field. And they put on an extraordinary show. I think a lot of our listeners right now may be headed to that game tonight. And last night they brought A.J. Pierzynski out and then shortly after A.J., I believe A.J. grounded out. Don't quote me on that. I'll have to check the Savannah Bananas box score. But after A.J. took his at bat, the Bananas unveiled the surprise pitcher out of the bullpen.
Now coming to pitch, a five-time All-Star and World Series champion, and his number 56 is retired here with the Chicago White Sox. Please welcome Mark Burley.
You have to love the showmanship. They do it well. They know what they know how to play to the crowd. I will say, though, for the Savannah Bananas, I think they undersold it because, yes, his number's retired, but they failed to mention he also has a statue that they unveiled earlier this season in right field. So you could have watched Burley pitch for the Savannah Bananas and then gone and looked at and taken a picture of his statue out on the right field concourse. Nevertheless, though, it was, I think, from all the reports that I got and from the viewing that I took in on social media last night, lots of fans were very happy with the experience, and we actually have the play where Burley pitched to A.J. Pierzynski.
And now South Trimble on a couple hops to Ryan Cox, who pulls off the professor. A strike to Bill LeRoy over at first. And Mark Burley gets the job done, throwing to A.J. Pierzynski. The crowd goes wild here in right field.
They did indeed. And how about Coxie, Ryan Cox, pulling off the professor? I don't know what that is, but that is a move, I presume. I have seen some of the – I've taken in a few innings of banana ball on the ESPN broadcast over the last season here. Do you? I'm looking at executive producer Brendan Riley right now. Do you know what the professor is?
Only because I saw the play when I was grabbing it.
Can you explain it to us?
It's just a behind-the-back dribble, basically.
Behind the back.
So he pounces it behind the back,
okay.
Grabs it again, and then makes the throw.
There you go. So Ryan Cox pulling off the professor as he was backing Mark Burley in the infield at Wright Field last night. And I'm sure there will be some surprises in store for tonight. You heard Sylvie with Len Casper wonder, could Jim Thome take a surprise at bat? Certainly a possibility. As Len mentioned, Jim still lives in the area, does some work with the White Sox organization. How about Ozzie Guillen? Ozzie Guillen, could he make a surprise appearance at shortstop? Ozzie's getting up there in age, so I don't know if he's going to go out there and throw the uni on, but I think it's certainly a possibility. Could he be a surprise manager for an inning? Maybe that's a possibility, although that never quite goes over quite as well as playing in the field. So how about the Big Hurt, Frank Thomas? Could we lure him in for a right field appearance one last time? I don't know. So should be fun for all those who are in attendance today for the final Savannah Banana game at Wright Field tonight. The rules of banana ball. This is what I want to talk about a little bit, because they obviously have done a good job of really tapping into the pulse of fans who want to be entertained. And I think ultimately sometimes we forget. We're so serious about sports that sometimes you forget the idea that what they're doing is actually entertainment, right? That is what I think the Bananas do so well as a company, is they play to the crowd. What can make this the most entertaining experience possible? And so I'd like to run through some of the rules along with Brendan Riley here as we kind of talk it through and just discuss what would and would not be possible for Major League Baseball to consider adopting here. You ready to play, Brendan?
Yeah.
All right. So some of the banana ball rules. Games are won by points instead of runs. The team that scores the most runs in an inning gets 1 point, all right? So you can't build up any huge lead in any individual inning, except in the final inning when every run counts as 1 point. Thus, this always makes it a possibility for a comeback win. Initial thoughts as I kind of lay that out, Brendan.
I think most of these rules, there is one on this list that I think it could be really interesting. I think most of these rules probably don't really play in Major League Baseball. I get why it's fun. I don't think this one would work.
Yeah. I think the idea of always having comeback wins in play is cool, except when you're getting really serious about a sport. Then it's like, okay, wait a minute. We're trying to play out a 162 game here. It might not work if you can't build up a big inning and have that basically carry you to a victory. I agree. That one's a non-starter. All right. How about this? A 2-hour time limit. No new inning may start after the 1 hour and 50 minute mark has elapsed.
I would not want to see the measures that would be taken to slow down games where you had a lead.
I think that's
happened.
I think that's a good, however, a lot of the rules in place that I will go through here in the next few basically address so that you can't have like extreme time wasting. For instance, a batter cannot step out of the batter's box. Doing so results in an automatic strike.
That's interesting. Like, you can't, I think there's, unfortunately, like, you just can't always do that, right?
Yeah.
There are times you have to have some leeway.
And I do think Major League Baseball's adoption of the pitch clock has, for the most part, addressed the egregious nature of the famous, you know, the old Nomar Garcia-Para stepping out of the backs. playing with his batting gloves for an excessive length of time in between each and every pitch. I think the pitchers, the pitch clock has kind of addressed that. How about this one? Batters cannot bunt. And I love doing so results in an automatic ejection.
It's funny.
Yeah. I wonder, yeah, I mean, I guess if you're going to be ejected immediately, it basically puts into place there's no reason to bunt.
And if guy wants to take a day off, he bunts.
Yeah, I guess in what happens if you actually do bunt, sure, you might be ejected, but then does it also result in an out? It doesn't say here on what I'm working off of, so I you know, again, this is where the unfamiliarity with banana ball comes in as a huge blind spot for me. How about this one? Batters can attempt to steal first base at any point during their at-bat. So it's not just drop third strike here, but if there happens to be any passed ball or wild pitch, you can go ahead and steal first base and just throw the at-bat up in the air. What do you think about that one?
You know, this wasn't the one I was referring to.
Mm-hmm.
You could convince me this could work. I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily a major improvement to the game, but I don't see why it couldn't be in play. What's the downside?
No, my question would be, it's enough players. Are they so worried about potentially giving up an at bat and statistically maybe like an opportunity? You know, would there be certain players that you'd be like, listen, I don't care if it's a wild pitch, you could take the base, but honestly, and because think about the game is all about getting on base, but to a certain extent too, there are the occasional, you do want certain players not taking, or not that you don't want them taking walks, but you want them to have the opportunity to do some damage.
It would be rarely used for sure.
But there would be certain players in your lineup that you would absolutely encourage to be like, take that base.
Same kind of guys who might try and bunt for a base hit, right?
Absolutely. For instance, yeah, earlier this year, you know, Jacob Amaya. Wild pitch, Jacob Amaya, try and steal first base. Go for it. Walks are replaced by ball four sprints. So that they're just a play on the word, obviously, the walk. After ball four, the batter is allowed to advance as far as around the bases as they can while the ball is sequentially thrown to all of the fielders other than the pitcher, starting with the catcher. So around the horn, but basically you need to quickly move the ball around the infield so that you prevent the runner from taking an extra base on a, quote, walk because it's a ball four sprint. How about this? No mound visits are allowed. None. Thoughts?
I like a lot of the, like, you can get me listening on a lot of pace of play stuff. I think that's probably a little too extreme for the intense moments in baseball. I think those are probably a little bit too important.
If you want to talk extreme, how about this one? Foul balls caught by fans on the fly are counted as outs. Talk about fan involvement.
I think it is probably the most fun rule in banana ball. I don't think you could carry it over to Major League Baseball.
Yeah, I believe I heard or I read, I don't know how accurate this is, but were there five foul ball outs last night at Wright Field? I believe that was what I saw. Talk about, though, keeping fans locked into the game, right? Like, you're honestly, if you're in anywhere, any foul ball territory, you'd have to imagine that people would be upset if you had a chance to make a catch for your home team. And then what about the road? I guess what about the road team? Such a home field advantage play,
and it goes into two parts, right? It's a home field advantage, but it's also an advantage if you're a team that travels well.
Sure,
It's just if you got a bunch of your fans at other stadiums, that's a huge advantage.
And how about too? Like if you're a fan of the home team, but you've got an opportunity to catch a foul ball, are you going to forego the foul ball for the opportunity to give your team an edge?
I'll tell you this, for being at the stadium, it would probably make that a more intense experience.
Interesting. How about this one? Final one we'll do before we take a quick time out. The golden batter rule. One time in a game, a team may send any hitter in the lineup to bat in any spot. The goal of this rule is so a team can have their best hitter hit when the game is on the line.
I think this should be in baseball.
Interesting.
And I know there's probably a lot of people who hear me say that and they cringe. It makes them uncomfortable. I get it. I think my guess is most people who hear that and cringe probably felt the same way about the pitch clock. And most of them have probably changed their opinion. I think if you had never seen the sport of baseball before.
Yes. And you were starting from scratch.
Introduced to it today and this existed, you would like it. It just feels so different. But you can't convince me that the opportunity to have the best players play in the biggest moments is a bad thing. You just can't convince me of that.
I mean, I think that's ultimately, if you were to adopt it and get on board, the idea is, yes, the one of the biggest problems for baseball is in the biggest moments. You can't guarantee that your best players are going to be there at the plate. For instance, part of the reason there was such there was a lot of pomp and circumstance surrounding the World Baseball Classic when Japan and the U.S. played for the championship was that Shohei Ohtani was on the mound squaring off against Mike Trout. And it just happened to work out that way. But with the golden batter rule, you'd be able to basically manufacture this in each game once per game. And I'm not, you know what? I love baseball, and the traditionalist in me is okay with not having it. But if Major League Baseball wanted to adopt it, it certainly wouldn't bother me. I'd be like, you know what? Once a game, go for it. Keep it in your back pocket.
I have said I think that the pitch clock will be the best rule change that happens in my life across sports. I don't think this would be quite that, but I think it might be number two.
Talk about it would certainly change things. I think a lot of people might even be okay with it and get on board with it. They'd be okay with it during the regular season. I think in the playoffs, though, in a huge World Series matchup, if all of a sudden Game 7, you can say, hey, you know what? We haven't used our golden batter yet. Let's send it. That's the one where I think people would really – that's where it's like, I don't know if I could really just the traditional baseball fan in me can't let that happen.
In year one of the pitch clock, didn't it operate differently in the playoffs? It still existed, but I feel like they extended the time.
You may be right. I think you are right now.
Because I could just see if that's what you need to do, if you need to make this like a transition. I'm pretty confident if we got to see this, most people would decide, you know what, this is a great rule.
It's pretty cool.
And I think it would find its way into the postseason.
I think it's certainly possible. Jeff Meller, that is Brendan Riley, the executive producer of White Sox Baseball. This is White Sox Weekly as we're getting set for Sox and Royals game number 2 of 3 coming your way tonight. Officially, the pregame coverage will start at 5:30. But, of course, as I always note during White Sox Weekly, this is just an extension of the pregame coverage for you as we're talking White Sox and all things Major League Baseball. Sox fans, join us at the ballpark next Sunday, August 24th, as the White Sox take on the Twins at 1:10. The first 7,500 fans in attendance will receive a Southside legend Ken Griffey Jr. bobblehead presented by United, Chicago's hometown airline. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/promos. Maybe Tom Waddle will show up to snag himself a Ken Griffey Jr. bobblehead. Don't expect to see Tom Waddle there. But you can go and get yourself a Ken Griffey Jr. bobblehead. I'm Jeff Meller again. This is White Sox Weekly here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. Sox fans, bring your family to the ballpark with a family pack presented by ExxonMobil, starting at just $19. Each family member gets one ticket, hot dog, drink, bag of chips, cookie, plus a souvenir 125th anniversary water bottle. This includes all fees. For tickets, visit whitesox.com/family. Earlier this week, back on August 12th, we do the This Day in White Sox History segment. And August 12th, 2021, was the Field of Dreams game. The White Sox, of course, beat the Yankees. And so we reminisced, and perfect week to talk about it right here on White Sox Weekly as we fondly remember through some of those highlights.
Welcome to a very special night of White Sox baseball. We are in Dyersville, Iowa, at a recently built big league ballpark. It is the Field of Dreams game.
Haney on an 0-2.
Drilled in the air, deep left, and it is in the corn! Jose with a home run!
Aloy hits one deep to right field. That baby will go!
That is a three-run homer into the corn.
His first pitch to Zavala, hit in the air to right, and it's deep. Judge is back. This one's gone! Sebi Zavala, two-run homer. It is 7-3.
Wow.
Lead by Sebi. The pitch is hit in the air. Deep to right. That ball is gone. White Sox win. The Field of Dreams. 9-8 the final.
Light it up.
Can you believe it?
was meant to be. First game ever in Iowa.
That's the best game ever played in Iowa.
Pretty cool memories back August 12, 2021. Again, earlier this week, we reminisced about the Field of Dreams game, and it actually prompted a question during our Ask Len segment. Every day during a White Sox game, or every game, we give you the gateway to the booth during the bottom of the sixth inning. Today, it's going to be an Ask DJ day, but we actually had an Ask Len question yesterday when Len was asked about where that moment ranked for him amongst his calls. And so Len and DJ talked a little bit about their experience at the Field of Dreams game.
I'll answer it this way. I tend not to think too much about those calls. And, you know, if people like them, great. If they hate them, I guess that's fine, too. I just enjoyed being there. And I think, DJ, you would agree with me, just being in the ballpark for that night and that moment when Tim hit the home run, that's definitely one of the best moments of my career to say I was there.
Well, you know how I feel about it. That was one of the most exciting games for us to be part of just because of the setting. Not the magnitude of the game, the setting, the history that was being made by us playing there, and the outcome of the game, the excitement of it.
There have been a few calls I've had where I just become a fan, and that was one of them. I mean, it was total shock and surprise. It was like, boom, gone, game over.
Yeah, that
and
was,
it was after the White Sox blew the lead in the ninth.
Yes. I believe Stanton or Judge had just hit a three-run home run or something prior to that, and we had to win it back. It was just everything about it was magical. It was the first game of its kind, and it turned out to be one of the most memorable games because of the way the game turned out. Not of the significance of the outcome of it. It's just the game itself was fun.
Yep.
It was indeed one of my favorite memories as a White Sox fan, especially of recent era here. I was just looking back. You heard four home runs on the call by Len and DJ there. Jose Abreu hit his 23rd of the season that night back in 2021. Eloy Jimenez, a healthy Eloy Jimenez, hit his sixth of the season. Sebi Zavala hit his fourth. Remember Sebi Zavala as a catcher from time to time for that Sox team. And then, of course, Tim Anderson with the walk-off, the 13th home run of the season for him that year. And, boy, at the time, it certainly felt like the White Sox were the it team in all of baseball. With that win, they moved to 68-48 and beat the Yankees, who were 63-52 after that. And remember, it was interesting because Liam Hendricks actually gave up the lead. He blew a four-run lead. Aaron Judge homered in the ninth off of him. And then, of course, Tim Anderson came back and homered off of Zach Britton. So cool memories of that game earlier this week. Again, August 12th, 2021. When we come back, expecting to hear from White Sox current-day pitcher Martin Perez, who returned to the mound earlier this week after 4 months of rehab. We'll talk to him about what it was like finally getting back on the mound for the White Sox right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. Jeff Meller back on White Sox Weekly as we get set for game number 2 of 3 between the Southsiders and the Royals after the White Sox fall to KC 3-1 last night. And it is my pleasure right now here on White Sox Weekly to be joined by veteran Sox pitcher Martin Perez, who made his return to the mound back on Wednesday after almost 4 months off. Martin, congratulations, my man, for getting back on the mound. I have to tell you, it was, even though the game didn't go, I'm sure, the way you guys wanted with the loss, it was still fun to see you get back out on the mound after having gone through what you went through earlier this season.
Thank you very much, guys, for having me. And I think that it was one of the best, one of the important day for me after almost 4 months out baseball. And I'm glad to be back with the team and then, you know, trying to help them to win, you know, many games we can.
I love hearing you say it was important. What made it so important for you to get back out onto the mound? You mentioned being gone for 4 months, you know, dealing with that injury. Just how did you feel when you finally got the chance when you were building up and on Wednesday you were activated, and then how did it feel to actually get back out onto the mound?
I feel nervous, to be honest with you guys. I feel that I was doing my debut again, was a good feel, and I was so nervous, but I think that's good to have that, still having that, because I still love this game, and I was working so hard to get back and, you know, to be with the team again and, you know, help them and trying to be around the guys again. But that was a big moment for me, and I think this is one of the moments that I'm not going to forget.
I love hearing that, Martin. Martin Perez joining me here, that you say you were nervous. You're a veteran. You're, you know, 34 years old. You've been in this game for a long time. You've been on an all-star team. You've won a World Series. When was the last time you felt that nervous?
Oh, man, I feel that, I think, most of the time in every game, but you know, Sunday was, you know, was too much for me. Like, my heart was so fast, and my legs was shaking, and that was fun. You know, I think when you still have those feelings, it means that you still love this game, and, you know, I'm just trying to enjoy every moment in this club. And hopefully, you know, I'm trying to finish trying to see if I can come back next year.
Martin Perez joining me here on White Sox Weekly. Now, Martin, I don't know you well. I talk to you a little bit in the clubhouse, you know, at home games every now and then. But at the same time, from what I've observed, you seem like a really positive person. And if I'm wrong, you can certainly, you know, disagree with me.
No, but you're right.
I'm just curious. You're right. So how was it, you know, maintaining that positive attitude when you first got the news? You know, you went out in Fenway and you knew something didn't feel right. You know, how was it for you to maintain that positivity knowing that you were going to have to work through some stuff?
I think when you play in any sport, you have to be ready for any situation, you know, bad or good. And like you say, I've been in this game for a long time, and you know, I'm always ready for, you know, whatever moment that I have to face. And you know, I think what has helped me a lot was I was believing in the process. You know, was believing on my training staff, was believing on my coaches, my teammates. I got good support for them. And you know, when you have those kind of things in your mind and you got good people around, getting to that process is easy. You know, and I was trusting a lot. You know, I just got to the field doing all my stuff. You know, we went outside, run, do all my conditioning every day. And I think when you have that kind of mentality and that kind of attitude every day, like you want to get better and you're going to be healthy at some point, and good things going to happen.
Martin Perez of the White Sox joining me. He, of course, returned to the mound on Wednesday after his stint on the 60-day injured list. Martin, you talk about, you know, having good people around you. Well, I'll commend you. What I think has been very helpful for this White Sox staff, again, at least from what I've observed and the people I've talked to within the organization, you've been an extremely positive role model for some of the younger pitchers in the White Sox rotation and on the pitching staff. Why has it been so important for you to still be a veteran who these guys can, you know, bounce ideas off of and just talk to about pitching?
Because, you know, we talk about, you know, how we need to pitch, how you need to, you know, what you have to do when you see a couple teams from the hitter. But at the same time, for me, it's most important when I have a teammates around me, I want them to feel comfortable. I want you to feel that you're part of the team. It's not because I'm a veteran. You're not allowed to do whatever you want to do. I mean, you have to respect people, but if you feel good doing something and it doesn't bother me, why do you not keep doing it? Like, this is your moment. This is your time. You work so hard to get to this level. So enjoy this, because not many people have the chance that we have to play in the big league level. So that's my mentality when I'm around to a guy that they don't have a lot of experience. I just want them to feel that I'm another rookie, you know?
Yeah.
Because at the end, when I live from this sport, I just want people to remind me like as a good person, you know?
Yes.
Because I don't know how many friends I have in this level, but I feel that I have a lot. You know, and then when I'm not playing baseball anymore, I just want to go to the field and watch a game. And I want the guys who play when I was here to give me that feedback that, like, as a good guy, hey, you teach me a lot. Thank you. That's what I want to get when I retire. So But at the same time, that's who I am. You know, I'm not trying to be humble, or I'm not trying to be a leader because I want to be a leader now, because that's who I am. And, you know, growing up in baseball, when I got to the big league, I have a chance to play with a lot of superstars, especially with Adrian Beltre, and he teach me how to play the game. He teach me how that I need to teach the guys, like, hey, he teach me how to compete, even with pain. Like, you got to go out there and do your job, and sometimes you don't going to feel 100%, but if you can go outside and you can give us a 75% and you can get people out, we're going to need you. And that's one another thing that I just trying to explain to the to my pitchers, like, sometimes we maybe not going to have our best stuff, but if we have the right mentality and we go outside and we go outside and compete, you know, we're going to have, first of all, the support of our teammates, and secondly, good things going to happen because you're always positive and you're trying to do your job.
Yeah. Martin Perez joining me here on White Sox Weekly. Love to hear that, Martin. How about a couple of young catchers who you're now working with? Edgar Caro talked about how he was excited to have you back on the mound, and Kyle Teal as well. A couple of rookies. What's it like, you know, a couple having them in meetings and kind of just seeing their growth, and then also what you're trying to impress upon them being big league catchers?
Yeah, I mean, those guys have been doing a great job. I think they're getting better every day. I know when they got here for the first time was kind of like a hard for them to know more how you need to pitch in the big league level, how to know who's pitching, who's going to be next, how I'm going to call this guy. But as soon as you play in the game and you take, like, you can catch in, like, a different pitchers every day, you know what pitch you're going to call and in what moment you're going to call those pitches, because you know a little bit more your pitcher. But they've been doing a great job. I mean, they like I say, they want to get better, and that's a lot for me, because when you're in this level, you're never going to stop learning. Like, every day you're going to learn something new, and that's all about it, because nobody know everything, or nobody know at all, like, all the things in baseball. So I got 14 years and I'm still learning every day from my teammates, even from the people who's not playing baseball. I could learn, but you know, it's a process, and I think they're accepted the process, and they've been doing a great job, man.
Speaking of learning, you're absolutely right about that. I love that mentality, Martin. What about Will Venable? What are your impressions of him? He's a rookie manager, but he, like, I talk to him, you know, virtually every day, and he seems like somebody who just seems to get it. I love his positive attitude. What's been your impressions of playing for Will Venable?
He's good, man. He's one of the best, managers that I have in my career. I played with him too, and he was my bench coach for 2 years, and, you know, we have a lot of chance to talk in the past. And when he got this job, like 2-3 days after, he called me and he was like, "Hey, Martin, we want you. I need a guy like you in my clubhouse, and I need you to come with me." And I was like, "I'm available. I'm going to go there. I'm going to help you." Even when I got hurt in Boston, so that was on Friday. So Saturday, I went to a doctor. We checked the MRI, and then I jumped to the office with him and the bench coach, and I went like, "Bro, I'm not going to leave you alone on this process. Even if I'm going to get surgery, I'm going to get surgery to Texas and I come back, because I'm going to be here and I'm going to help you with this process. I'm going to be here for you. I'm going to be here for my teammates, and I want to be around, because I don't know if I'm coming back to playing baseball." So, but he's one of the top guys that I ever have in my career. As a player, was one of the best teammates, and as a coach now, as a manager, he's one of the top on my list. So he got a long career as a manager, because he's a good human being.
Well, we love to hear that, Martin. And let me tell you, you have, at least from my perspective, I didn't know you before the season, but watching you do your work, and more importantly, the attitude that you bring inside the clubhouse, you've earned a fan in me. So I've had a great time watching you pitch so far this season, And I was so happy to see you back out on the mound earlier this week. So keep on doing what you're doing, and you've made a fan of me. So thanks for joining me here on White Sox
Weekly. Thank you guys for having me. Have a good day, guys.
Our pleasure. Take care. Martin Perez returning from the 60-day injured list earlier this year, and he truly is one of the good guys in baseball. So was very happy to see him able to make his return, not have to have Tommy John surgery, and now hopefully finish off this season strong with the White Sox. Hey, Sox fans, join us at the ballpark on Tuesday, August 26th for the Chicago Sky Night presented by the Village of Bedford Park. Receive a co-branded Chicago Sky hat when you purchase a specially priced ticket. Limited availability. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/promos. When we come back, Scott Merkin, who covers the White Sox for MLB.com and was out for the Savannah Bananas game as well yesterday, will join me here on White Sox Weekly on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly as we're getting set for game number 2 of 3 between the White Sox and Royals tonight at Kauffman Stadium. It will be, again, the misery in Missouri. Can the White Sox finally end what has been an absolute house of horrors since 2023? Real quick, we're going to bring in Scott Merkin, but before we do that, let's pause 10 seconds for stations to identify themselves. Of course, Scott Merkin has covered the White Sox for a long time now for MLB.com, and he joins me now on White Sox Weekly. Scott, before we get into White Sox talk, I got to pick your brain because I saw that you have you covered the Savannah Bananas game last night at Wright Field, and I do believe we've probably got a lot of listeners who are en route right now to the game. So what was the experience like seeing it firsthand last night?
I should say off the bat, thanks for having me on, first of all. But second of all, I was off the first Kansas City series because I went to Charlotte to see
Tim Elko
and at that point Kyle Teal and everyone else. And I'm off this weekend, leave for Atlanta on Monday. And so I've missed all 5 losses this year in Kansas City, although I've seen many in the past, many in the past.
So you know,
it was a great experience. It was a lot of fun, and I will say it was pretty surprising to see. I had an inkling maybe AJ, because I knew he – I mean, I thought maybe his broadcast schedule would take him this way for the weekend, but to see Mark Burley out there and talk to him about it afterwards was very entertaining. It's a great experience. You know, I mean, there is good baseball being played. I mean, it's not really even minor league baseball, but, I mean, it's all about the fans.
Absolutely.
It really is, and the fans love it. I mean, they knew every bit. They knew every song that they sang along with. I mean, it was very intense, and, of course, when AJ walked out there and then Burley walked out there, and the first time that he's thrown to AJ since 2011 when they were last teammates, it was a great experience. I imagine they'll have, you know, weather permitting, more surprises tonight too. I don't think it'll be either. Well, I know it's not AJ because he's broadcasting the Yankees at Cardinals game, he told me. So he won't, unless he's doing it by osmosis, he won't be there. And I doubt Mark is back again.
Yeah.
Mark was durable, but he didn't pitch back-to-back games even when he was pitching. So I don't think he'll be out there again tonight, but It was just a cool, you know, it's as good as I heard. And, you know, even being off this weekend, I wanted to take a look at it. And I admit I got there a little bit later. So it was a 7 o'clock start and I got there about 5:45. But I know there's a whole pregame activity that goes with it, too, that I probably kind of missed out on. But people just seem to have fun. And that's what it's, you know, Brooks Boyer said afterwards, said to me, that, you know, there's a lot that can be learned from their approach for just major league teams. Now, obviously, major league players are not doing backflips when they catch fly balls in center field, not intentionally at least. But, I mean, that fan first thing is, you know, as you said, it's kind of modeled on the Bill Veeck model. There's a lot that can be taken from what they do, and they do it so successfully. I mean, I was asking one young lady who works for them, and I think they had 80,000 at a game at Clemson this year. So pretty amazing.
Yeah, no, they do it right, and certainly – It's the perfect barnstorming model, right? You know, you come in for a couple
Absolutely.
Of days and you create the, you know, oh, everybody wants to go. You create that limited availability and it works well. And to your point, though, it's all about the fans. And I think that is, you know, don't forget that. You know, sometimes I think major league sports, not baseball, but just all of them, sometimes they do forget that. And I think that's kind of what the Bananas have really tapped into. So great experience.
Yeah, for our profession, you know, maybe covering 10, 15 of those in a row might get a little different for us. But I think the fans, you know, like you said, it's a different city every weekend. So they, you know, it's a new experience, except for those who have, you know, repeat thing. I did joke with Burley that I said, I thought, you know, the first pitch he threw was 94. And he said, what gun were you using on that? And I said, well, just my eyes. And he goes, you need to get those checked in that case. And so,
the banana
same,
gun.
Same humor that he had. Same humor that he had when he pitched. So.
I love it. I love it. Scott Merkin joining me here on White Sox Weekly with your bananas breakdown for all the folks who are headed in now. I know that, like I said, my family's going tonight. So I know lots of people are out there probably listening.
A lot of people went. Yeah. Just based on like my Instagram of friends there, every like about 8 of every 10 had some picture of the bananas game on it last night. And I'm sure there'll be just as many tonight and with another 40,000 expected.
Yeah. So, all right. So let's turn our attention to KC and why it's been so difficult for the White Sox to get a win there, aside from obviously the luck that you bring with the team here. All right. I don't know what to say, because I guess since the All-Star break, and, you know, I will self-admit, Merk, that the arbitrary endpoint sometimes, you know, it's a broadcasting trick. Hey, look at how good they've been over this period of time here. But I do wonder, like, you know, there for me has been a tangible difference. It's something the organization has talked about. Both Chris Getz and Will Venable have hit on. They needed to be better taking advantage of fastballs. And that's something they did out of the gate in the second half. So, you know, you give me an anecdote and I'll say, okay, maybe there's something here. And obviously they've done a much better job slugging here in the second half. Do you think they've actually turned the corner on that, or do you think it's still, you know, TBD on?
It's so hard to tell because, you know, this game is more than anything about adjustments, right? So they adjusted coming out of the break, and, you know, we've talked a lot about that meeting they had that first day in Pittsburgh about, you know, being more aggressive. And even Mike Kaufman told us that weekend about, you know, it's great to get to 2-0 and 3-1 counts, but make sure you don't let your pitch pass by. You know, I'm paraphrasing there, obviously, but, you know, go after the pitch you want. And they certainly did. I mean, you could, now again, apples and oranges, different times of the season, different pressure on different teams. But, you know, the Sox were in Pittsburgh those three games against a Pittsburgh team that did not feature Paul Skeens or Mitch Keller. Same as the Cubs this weekend. And look at the offensive production. And again, maybe a bad comparison. I'm just saying that you can't just knock it out and say, well, it's Pittsburgh and Pittsburgh's horrible. You know, they hit the hell out of the ball that weekend. They did the same at Steinbrenner Field in Tampa. And I think they're still, if not leading, their top two or three in home runs since the All-Star break.
Correct.
Which,
yes,
obviously, you know, you can't rely on the homer, but it makes a difference, right? You can change the game in one swing of the bat, and we've seen that happen a couple of different times. So I think there's improvement. And I think the thing you got to look at from this year more than anything is guys like Colson and Chase Meidroff, and I'm going to forget guys, and I go through, you know, Edgar Caro and Kyle Teal and Sean Burke, who's pitching tonight, and this whole crew, Davis Martin even, who's been up a little bit before this, they're all gaining valuable experience they'll take into their first full season next year. So whatever the record ends up, whether it's a third straight 100-loss season, whether they finish strong and get up in the 60s or maybe even, you know, probably 60s win total, you know, it's moving on to next year. Now, of course, when the time is right, and I'm not sure if that's going to be this offseason or the offseason after, you know, they're going to need to supplement this team. You know, they have a lot of good young players, but they're going to have to decide, which is one of the points of this year in the rebuild, who fits, who might be part of a move that you make to, you know, open up other spots and go forward and then add some guys through free agency. It's got to happen, and every rebuild has to finish that way. You know, I think it was Benintendi, Andrew Benintendi, who pointed out to me, there's very few teams that win purely on a rebuild. You know, you have to add on to that. So to make a long answer short, I think there has been improvement, and that's the key thing. And you saw it was pretty amazing. I mean, you watched it, those first six games.
Yeah,
it was just a completely different team. You know, I mean, they pounded the baseball, and they've gotten, you know, decent pitching. But I think the thing to focus on is just the experience and the improvement you're seeing. And then you hope that it's linear and it carries into the 2026 season. You hope there's no regression. There's always somewhere along the way. It's a 162 game season. But you hope that this experience they've gained, and there's a lot of guys who've gotten, you know, quite a bit of experience, really sets them up to maybe even by the second half of next season, they can be a division competitive team. What are they? I think 12-13 since the break right now,
yes,
which is not great, but it's certainly not 33 under, which they were before the break, right? So
absolutely,
they're making small steps going forward, and you hope that it just continues in the process.
No doubt about it. Scott Merkin, who covers the White Sox for MLB.com, joining me here on White Sox Weekly. I'm Jeff Meller as we get set for game number 2 of 3 between the White Sox and Royals tonight. First pitch coming your way at 6:10. What about Jonathan Cannon, Scott? What do you think the long-term outlook for him is? You mentioned Burke, Martin. We know that, you know, Shane Smith has been a revelation, and
sure,
hopefully he's getting back to pitching the way he was when he was, what helped make him an all-star after his last couple of starts. Long-term, what the rotation might look like, we know that Schultz and Hagen Smith, if things go according to plan, hopefully they'll be in the rotation within the next 18 months here. So I guess, what does the future hold for someone like Jonathan Cannon? And do you think the White Sox will be looking at potentially trading one of those guys, whether it be Burke, Martin, Cannon, in the offseason here, with the idea that, you know, if that you probably can't have all of them in the rotation long term?
Right. And you got to figure out what you're doing with Grant Taylor, too, right?
Yes.
Is he going to continue to be a late inning key leverage guy, even a closer, or do you, you know, follow the Chris Sale, Garrett Crochet, even for a very short period, Mark Burley prototype, where, you know, they pitch in relief for a year or two and then move into the rotation after that? So, yeah, I mean, you can't have seven or eight pitchers. And obviously there's going to be a veteran mix, veteran or two mixed in there too, right? I mean, I would guess Martin Perez, if he shows, as Martin was telling me since the series in at Dodger Stadium, that, you know, he was coming back this year, he did, and that he said he knows he can get people out, but he's got to show other teams he can get people out to, and that probably includes the White Sox.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not sure if, you know, there's a mutual option there, so I'm not sure if that will be enacted or if they'll, you know, there would be a chance to bring him back maybe for a lesser salary. Who knows? That's just totally spitfiring.
Yep.
But, yeah, I mean, you're not going to keep everyone, right? Now, in Jonathan Cannon's case, one thing the Sox have done very well this year, and it's part of the rebuild, it's part of a team that's not, you know, going to win the division or be close to the playoffs, is that you can take these guys who matter, and remember, not matter, that's a bad choice of words, but who are integral to your future, and give them resets, give them a chance to bounce back. Remember, Jonathan Cannon was, I guess, I don't know if you agree, Jeff, but probably the second most effective starter for the whole season behind Garrett Crochet last year, right?
Yeah, for a good stretch, no doubt.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like Jonathan was bad and just got worse. He was, you know, he's hit a little bit of a funk, and it might be related to
the back,
you know, the back issue that he had, which he definitely talked about pitching through when he probably shouldn't have. So I think the reset is great. It worked for Colson. They did a reset with Hagen Smith. They did one with Jairo Ariarte. So, again, I don't think, you know, what he does in Charlotte at all matters. If he gives up 10 runs in two innings or strikes out 14 over, you know, five innings, it doesn't matter. It's all about the work that, you know, Brian Bannister and Scott Allred and Sergio Santos down there in Charlotte are doing with him. And just the mindset for Jonathan. Jonathan's a strong kid. You know, I was talking to Davis Martin, who's a good friend of Jonathan's and, you know, rotation mate right after it happened. He said, sometimes it takes like one start to click.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think he'll be back up here, if not before September 1st, by September, and get a chance to, you know, finish out the season. But again, it's not the worst thing, because once again, they're looking at the innings total, and it's probably a little easier to go down to Charlotte and work on things, almost like a glorified spring training, like they did with Colson in Arizona and Hagen Smith in Arizona, as opposed to, you know, being on the center stage where you're getting hit a little bit. So I think he's still in the mix, and I think it's up to Chris and Josh Barfield and Jin Wong and everyone else there to, you know, Brian Bannister, to figure out how they fit and how everyone else fits into this puzzle moving forward. They have a good depth of talent. It's just a question of who are the key pieces and who do you deem as, I don't know if it's movable or maybe not on that same level as the higher echelon.
Scott Merkin joining me here on White Sox Weekly for another minute here on ESPN 1000, the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. Scott, you talked a little bit about, you know, supplementing the, you know, the rebuild. You can't just, you know, have a winning team through all, you know, prospects that come up through your organization. No team does it that way. That's just not reality. I'm looking at the roster, and obviously Chase Mydroth and Colson Montgomery look like the, you know, the foundation up the middle. We're seeing what Curtis Meade is. Miguel Vargas, either way, I'd imagine he'll be a part of the corner infield spots, one of them.
Absolutely.
You know, whether it's first or third. We'll see how Meade plays right down the stretcher. What do you think about the idea of, you know, someone like Josh Naylor, who's a free agent in the offseason, who White Sox fans, you know, go crazy every time he comes to the plate because he's just an absolute Sox killer. Is being in the market for a corner infielder, first baseman long term, is that just a bad use of resources? Or do you think, you know, a veteran hitter who's just a professional could be of some use to the White Sox next offseason?
Yeah, I think if it's the right guy, it's a very good source or use of resources, right? I mean, Josh Naylor is not just – we've seen him. You know, anyone who's covered the White Sox has seen Josh Naylor in action. I still remember when he hit the grand slam off Liam Hendricks and the three-run homer off Ryan Burr and then almost killed Terry Francona when he went to celebrate the dugout. And it was genuine. It wasn't like he was putting on some show. He was just that fired up. And he's the kind of guy, you know, winning teams want. It's why Seattle, who is now probably one of the better teams in the AL, went after him, right? I mean, because he has shown that in Cleveland. He showed it, you know, early on in Arizona. So it would make sense. Now, I'm just saying, in general, it fits. You have no idea what the market's going to be for him, and maybe the market won't be what they want in terms of what they're spending overall this offseason. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, definitely. I mean, they have almost nothing on the books, right? Yep. I mean, assuming they pick up Luis Robert's option, that's $20 million. They have Andrew Benintendi's contract, which I think is like $17.1 million. There's whatever the buyout is for Martin Perez, and then basically it's just everyone else on the roster, right? So those are the three. And even if you count, you know, it really is just two big expenditures. So even if the payroll does not go up astronomically, you still have quite a bit of room to spend, right? So there's enough, I shouldn't say quite a bit, but enough to really make a difference. So maybe that is a guy. Maybe it's like a Ryan O'Hearn, I believe was a free agent also. But yep. Yeah, I think just in general, teams would like, or the Sox pitchers would like to see Naylor on their team, not to have to face him anymore, because he does annihilate him. It's like the old Ryan Rayburn days when he was with Cleveland, when I think like a third of his RBIs for his career were against the White Sox. But Naylor is a very good player. He would be a very good fit. The little I know of him and the little I've talked to people and what I've heard about him for a team that's on the rise, or hopefully on the rise, as the White Sox are. But again, all depends on the market, and probably too early to say 100% you have to go after him. You know, like just real quickly going back to, you know, the end of the last rebuild, you know, Harper and Machado made perfect sense then, right? That's what they needed at the end of the rebuild. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if there's one guy out there for this class that you can say, oh yeah, you have to get him for the White Sox. So there'll be a lot of moves in motion for Chris Getz and company going into the offseason.
Great stuff. I completely agree, Mark. As always, appreciate your time. Thanks for joining me. I know you're not in KC, but thanks for carving out some time here on White Sox Weekly. Always appreciate it, man.
No problem. And I hope everyone enjoys, who's going out to the Bananas game tonight, enjoys the experience. Great time.
I have no doubt they will. Scott Merkin, again, longtime beat reporter for the Chicago White Sox, works for MLB.com and is essential to reading if you want to keep up to date on what's going on with your White Sox. I'm Jeff Meller. We're getting set for White Sox and Royals pregame coverage, specifically. We'll start in about 10 minutes from now as we have game number 2 of 3 between the White Sox and Royals at Kauffman Stadium. Hey, students, it's easier than ever to get your friends together for a White Sox game. Sign up for student pass alerts and get exclusive access to lower-level ticket offers. Text STUDENT to 244-769 to sign up. Again, that's STUDENT to 244-769 or visit whitesox.com/student for more information. When we come back, we'll get you set for White Sox and Royals coming your way at 5:30, first pitch at 6:10, right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. Jeff Meller back on White Sox Weekly as we wrap up this edition, getting set for White Sox and Royals at Kauffman Stadium. The White Sox are in KC, and they have lost 9 of their last 11 games after that 10-4 start to the second half. So hopefully we can get back to playing the type of baseball that they were right out of the All-Star break. That would be much better than what we've seen over the last couple of weeks, and certainly trying to end what has been absolutely miserable in KC these days. The White Sox lost 3-1 last night. It'll be Sean Burke opposing Michael Lorenzen, who returns from his rehab stint as he's coming back from the injured list. So hopefully the White Sox can get a pitcher who's not completely acclimated. Hopefully that is the case. If you missed the conversation with Martin Perez, who joined me earlier today on White Sox Weekly, he was fantastic. Fun to see him back on the mound earlier this week against the Tigers on Wednesday. It was a fun conversation. Check out the interview available on the podcast on ESPN, on the ESPN Chicago app. Also going to play for you a couple of sound bites from him coming up in the pregame show if you missed it. So thanks to Martin Perez for joining me, as always. Thanks to Scott Merkin as well. He covers the White Sox for MLB.com. job well done from Merck, as he gave us not just a White Sox breakdown, but also a Savannah Bananas recap from last night, as they're also set to play tonight at Wright Field. That's going to do it for this edition of White Sox Weekly. Thanks, as always, to the executive producer of White Sox Baseball. That is Brendan Riley. I am Jeff Meller. Stay tuned, though, because we got your pregame coverage of White Sox and Royals coming up next, right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
You have access to a team of real professionals to help you make smarter financial decisions. When you bank with Marquette Bank, good things happen for you and your neighborhood. Marquette Bank, love where you bank. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS number 462926.
All right, Abdallah, let's set the scene. A hot summer day, ball game on the radio, burgers on the grill. What's missing?
A beer that won't slow me down. I'm grabbing a Flight by Yuengling.
Flight is the next generation of light beer. It's crisp. It's refreshing. It's only 2.6 carbs and 95 calories. It's perfect for extra innings or extra rounds.